Allen Ginsberg here, announcing that this is station WCBN, FM, Ann Arbor, your Dharmic free speech station.
You're listening to WCBN, FM, Ann Arbor. Up next is Living Writers, a replay of an episode from December 6, 2023 with poet Ross Gay, who was back in town this past weekend for an event at Pioneer High School, Poems for the People, celebrating 30 years of Ann Arbor poetry and community. Hope you enjoy the show. Stay tuned.
My eyes are green, 'cause I eat a lot of vegetables. It don't have nothing to do with your new friend. My eyes are green, 'cause I eat a lot of vegetables. It don't have nothing to do with your new friend. I don't care.
Good afternoon. You're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm Tia Hetzel, and today I am absolutely delighted to have Ross Gay here in the studio with me down here at WCBN Pride A, and Jason Voss behind the glass. And thanks to DJ Lambchop for her always excellent program. I feel like we're the luckiest. We've got the luckiest spot here after her. Today, I've got the book on the table with us. Well, we've got a few, but the latest, The Book of More Delights, out with Algonquin Press this September. On the table with us, we also have The Book of Delights, which I was saying just before we came on air to Ross, I believe is a modern American classic. And we have Inciting Joy, another collection of Ross's essays earlier, I think it was 2019, and Beholding, a book of poems, an epic poem, a very long and wonderful poem on the table with us too. Ross, you've got other books there too. What did you bring?
This is the Book of More Delights without the cover on it.
Ah, oh, it is. So, and so it is.
Yep. And then one of the copies of Inciting Joy as well. And then this other book is, it's by Juliana Spahr, called This Connection of Everyone with Lungs, that I'm reading. This is
beautiful. Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, well, thanks for also letting us know what you're reading.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the book in your bag right
second,
now.
Yeah. Yeah. One of them, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
Ross,
I'm so glad to be here.
And coming to Ann Arbor on the winter month of December.
Yes. It's a real place in December, isn't it?
Is it much different than Indiana? Or
it's just a little bit colder. But I do remember, partly I sort of think of one of the last times I was here, it would have been in like January or February, but it could have been the fall. I can't remember. But I think, and I may have made this up, but I think it was the coldest day in the history of Ann Arbor or something.
I think
I remember being
like
negative.
Was it like the polar vortex or something?
It might have been, yeah. And it was like, I think it was negative 18 that day. I think.
Oh, no.
I think.
Oh, well, this is balmy.
Oh, it's balmy.
Yeah. Because that was the, I remember that. They were saying for students and us to get to class, they were like, maybe you should wear safety goggles. And we're like, okay. It would be nice if that was like a welcome pack.
Yeah,
that
totally.
You got, you know, right. You came here.
That's so great. I think
the scientists were all like, finally.
Right,
yeah,
right,
this
right.
is like, we've been telling you we're more prepared than you know.
Totally.
And also just a quick shout out. Thanks to folks listening and to poet Katie Hartsock, who just sent a text to let us know she'd be listening and remembering a panel in Youngstown, Ohio that you all did. And you... And you remember that one. What is it about Youngstown?
I was born in Youngstown.
That's... You... Okay. when I was reading about that, I thought you might have moved there from somewhere else, but obviously I'm wrong. So you were born in Youngstown.
Yeah, so I was born in Youngstown and then moved when I was, I think probably, I was like two. My dad worked at Pizza Hut, and then we would just move around like Pizza Huts that he was working at. So it was kind of the Northeast Ohio, Elyria, Painesville, one other, like Stowe. I think Stowe was a little town up there. And then we moved outside of Philadelphia. And that's where I grew up. But I have a lot of family still in Youngstown. So when I go there, and between the time actually that I started writing this book and now, there were four of my elders, my father's aunts and uncles and mother were alive. And now there's one left. So it was a 3-day festival, the Youngstown Literary Festival. Lovely literary festival for anyone who's around and want to go down there. And
it's not a far trip.
No,
it's
not
like,
far.
What, 5 hours?
I bet.
Maybe,
yeah.
Or so. Yeah.
And so I got to spend a lot of time with my aunt and also do this great festival.
Is that where your uncle, who's the doctor?
He lives in Philly, but he's part of that Youngstown family.
Okay.
Yeah. It's my dad's family from there.
Because I know he figures into Inciting Joy at the beginning with it.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, Ross, this is a week. You have a week residency, as it's called here. how are you finding your residency so far?
It's great. You know, I'm just meeting with students, so getting, you know, familiar with grad student work here, and which is, you know, quite like grad student work where I teach. So I'm on sabbatical this year, partly because I'm on tour, like a kind of a thorough tour with this Book of More Delights. And yeah, so it's just kind of cool to get to hang out with students in a way that I haven't actually done too much this semester. See what people are working on, what they're thinking about. You know, just think together about some words for a little bit. It feels kind of fun.
I feel like everyone, now I'm going to try to speak for everyone, which is always a good thing to do. Right? But I was going to say, we're so lucky to have you here this week. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, I'm glad to
Michigan.
Be here. Yeah, love it here.
You're doing a reading tomorrow at the Art Museum at UMA.
Oh, okay.
At Helmut Stern Auditorium.
That's okay, great.
That,
yeah.
Okay.
That's what it's called.
Okay.
That sounds right. I know it's tomorrow.
And so that'll be tomorrow. I think it's, I should have looked this up to be sure, 5 or 5:30?
Yeah, it's one of those. I might have it in a piece of paper here that I'll look at.
So we can, we'll do that at the break. Ross, we've already got a thing to do. And then you're giving a craft talk.
Yeah, I think
as
on
well.
10 o'clock maybe the following morning.
In Angel Hall.
Oh, you got
and
it.
That's, and I did know that was 10 a.m. I knew that one.
Okay.
And that'll be in room 3222. Okay. I think the Goldstein room.
Yeah, okay.
I think. But I know it's room 322, everyone. 3222. It's got an extra two, it seems. But
okay.
It's the lucky number two. So, Ross, I'm obviously a bit too giddy to have you here. I'm going to settle down and read your bio from the back of the Book of More Delights.
Great.
Ross Gay is the author of the essay collections The Book of Delights and Inciting Joy and 4 books of poetry. The recipient of numerous writing awards, he lives in gardens in Bloomington, Indiana, where he also teaches at Indiana University. His website is rossgay.net. So, Ross, let's start with the Book of More Delights.
Yeah.
And early on, in the beginning, you talk about how it came to be. Because you're actually thanking a friend for, I think it was taking place in Marfa, Texas.
Yeah,
could you take us to that? And
I was with my friend Patrick Rosal, who's a beautiful poet, among other things. He's also writes beautiful essays and musical compositions, and can dance and lots of other stuff too. But anyway, he and I were at the Lannan Foundation thing in Marfa, where they put you up for a little bit. And we were together while I was concluding the first Book of Delights. And for those of you who don't, for your listeners who don't know what that book is, it's effectively every day for a year, I decided to write a short essay about something that delighted me. And so I was there. I decided to do it from August 1st to August 1st, my birthday to my birthday. I'm a Leo.
Rawr.
And we were there until about August 8th or something. And when I finished it, Pat said, are you going to keep going or what are you going to do? And I hadn't yet quite puzzled it all out. But talking to him, it made me think, I think it was there, if not there, it was shortly after, but it was definitely with his prompting and his question. I thought, oh, this is a kind of project that I could do every 5 years or something. You know, at the time I might have thought every 3 years or every 5 years or every seven, I don't know. But for now, it's every 5 years. So the second one came out, or I wrote it 5 years later, so which was interesting because I started the first one, I think, on my 42nd birthday. Then I started this one on my 47th birthday. So it's just like sort of an interesting project, sort of watching how things change. And actually, when you do a project over 5 years, how one of the primary subjects is aging, actually.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's kind of neat.
And it'll be maybe aging and generous for you to be able to share that with folks, especially if this is a project that you really do every 5 years. Does it feel what does that feel like to think forward like that and think about aging? And
I'm reading right now Ann Waldman's book Bard Kinetic. It's a memoir. And
she's amazing.
And I love her work and I love her spirit and her like work, what she does. And I was reading in there and she's talking about her book Jovis, I think is that how you say it.
It's massive.
And I think it was sort of like a 25-year project.
Yes, I think it is.
And I just love that. I have it and it's gigantic. It's like, you know, and I love that. What's the word? It's a kind of endurance in a artistic endeavor, in any kind of endeavor, but like an artistic endeavor is really, really interesting to me, you know? And so while I was thinking about this book as it was finishing up, I was like, oh, you know, I love like Robert Motherwell's Elegy to the Spanish Republic series, like paintings, versions of paintings that he made for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years, I guess. There's probably hundreds of them. I'm so interested in that. I'm interested in people who sort of keep on trying to reiterate in a certain kind of way the same thing, or like the long durational project, I think is how you say it. And so I'm interested very much in the idea of like, what would it look like if I live another 5 years, I get another one of these in. If I live another 25 years, I get another five of these in. That's interesting to
me. And five more? I'm thinking
Yeah. So that's an interesting project, just in terms of like, what does it mean to sort of follow someone's thinking in a serious way over the course of their lives?
And so, because it is like the project itself is a short essay. Yeah. It's loose. Loose constraints.
Yeah.
But every day.
Yep.
Some of them may not be included. There are some days that are skipped for like different reasons. You say in the book.
And there are the constraints are to write them every day, write them by hand, and write them quickly, 30 minutes or less. Draft them 30 minutes or less. So I probably wrote, I don't do every day, but I get pretty damn close. And on this book, I probably wrote 350. So, and there's 81 or something in the book, or 80, I don't know.
How do you choose them?
Well, you know, partly I was trying to figure out how not to be, you know, redundant, because if you're writing something every day, you're going to kind of get into grooves
Well, and for good reason, too, because there's things that we're mulling over.
Totally. Yeah. So that's part of the thing. Because you're trying to make a book, you know.
Because you have that constraint, I guess, that vision.
Yes, maybe. Exactly. And that part of it sort of comes after the writing. So after you've written all the stuff, now you're trying to sort of decide what will make the best book. So that includes, pulling out the redundancy stuff, you know, pulling out just some of the stuff I couldn't quite make into what I think of as interesting essays, you know. And one of the main barometers for that is if I saw or had an experience that felt delightful, and I kind of knew why it was delightful from the start, I was just telling you why it was delightful, probably not going to be an interesting essay to me.
And why?
Because the reason that I write, I think I can pretty safely just say this clearly, is that I want to be transformed in the process of the writing. So I want to have a question, I want to write from a question, and I want the question to lead my to lead my writing, actually. So, which is also to say that a way that I like to put it now is that I like to be unmade by the writing. You know, I like to be unmade, and that's my aspiration. And when you just sort of say what you know, you're not really unmaking anything. You're sort of imposing something, you know. So that's sort of, that's the dream.
But because it's this idea of then it's alive because you're following your critical thinking, your mind, or your inventive mind to discover something that may not have already been, like there might have been observation or like, but it not fully logged in yet. Yeah. You don't have a path to it necessarily.
Yeah. And you're trying also to, you know, it's difficult to sort of, sometimes it can be difficult to make something that, or to sort of honor what we don't know and value what we don't know. That can feel difficult sometimes. And so, but I think it's, you know, it's how we think best is really, actually, I think maybe that's a safe thing to say, is that we think best when we honor what we don't know, you know? And that probably pushes us into all kinds of realms in a certain kind of way. But in terms of writing, that's one of my, and teaching, it's one of my things, it's one of my hopes, is to sort of be able to sort of be tenderly with what I don't know, you know?
And when you say pushing us into all sorts of things, you mean the realm of being human?
Yeah, totally. I mean, when you don't know, you become suddenly sort of, you become more of a creature. Because mostly we just don't know.
Yeah.
We mostly just don't know. And there's something so beautiful to me about the, you know, just sort of like being intimate with one's need, or one as a creature, which means one as a needing thing in a circuit of needing things.
Yes, the interdependence.
The interdependence, yeah. And to be someone who... To be capable or interested in learning as an act of unknowing oneself, you know?
Yes.
That then sort of implies, I think, that we might always be in that process in relation to one another, you know? Writing, and, you know, and there's another thing that to me, writing is very much a process of getting to know oneself, by which I also really mean getting to unknow oneself. So it's a relationship with oneself as well. You know what I mean? Yeah. The writing that I'm interested in, I should say, you know, I mean, I could be interested in like a super, you know, kind of like down the middle biography too. That's just like telling a bunch of facts. I can be interested in that, but I'm really more interested in watching each other change. I'm more interested in how we witness each other change, you know, and that's kind of the aspiration.
And the poems and the short essay, those feel like perfect forms for that.
Totally.
Because especially the short essay, to make an attempt.
Yes.
Right? Like that in its origin.
Yeah. Essays are attempts.
And it feels like for so many years, at least how we're all somehow, well, you know, going to school, public school system, you're like, the essay is this thing.
Yes.
And it's almost like a vehicle of not always regurgitation, but sometimes, like, as you're taught, like, because there's so many constraints on it.
Yeah.
And you're just meant to give back the same.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to be an honest attempt. It's meant to prove some sort of, you were paying attention.
Yeah, totally.
But in a... like not in the way that you write about paying attention your books, in very different controlled environment for specific purposes.
I mean, to be paying close attention means to be unknowing oneself constantly. It means to be being unmade.
Because you're opening.
You're always constantly. Opening. You're always, that means you're changing. But I think a kind of, you know, like, an essay which sort of depends on the premise of the thesis, which you're going to prove, that suggests a kind of fixedness. That suggests a kind of imposition of one's ideas upon the world and each other, as opposed to this other thing, which is like, well, what? I don't know. let me wonder, you know. That's sort of the hope, to like wonder in each other's presence.
Yes.
You know, and to care for that wonder.
Yes, and the wonder in its the many ways of its meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like wonder, like the noun, does not exist absent unknowing.
Right, because do you say in your book, Descartes has the... I'm getting confused about which one. Is it in the most recent one, Ross? Does it bring us back to the Book of More Delights?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, then. Well, then. Let me see. I can find that. I can find that. It's in this.
I think it's early on.
Yeah, I found it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's your book.
I am... this is an essay in which I talk about... Maybe I'll just read the essay. Okay. It's called The Full Moon. Friends, I am 47 years old, nearly a half century of living under my belt, and it was only today, reading about herbs and tinctures and planting schedules and various other astro-agronomical affairs, that I learned, I am so shy to admit it to you, that the moon wanes into blank. I knew it waxed into full, but the waning part into no moon, which they call new moon, somehow eluded me, which I'm guessing it didn't you. You probably learned it and kept it learned in fourth grade or something. Not me. For some reason, I was under the impression, clearly not the observational impression, that it goes from super bright, full, werewolves and such, to off, like hitting a light switch. I mean... I mean, look, I'm only now learning this despite the fact that, among other things that might have hit me, like my eyes, despite the cognitive acrobatics I've been doing to keep my understanding in place, like not believing my eyes, I believe 1,000% that the moon, given as it affects the waves in the ocean, and given as we are mostly ocean, affects us profoundly. The moon may have chosen a few of the words in that last sentence. I am all the way on that team and have been for a little while now, even though I was quite slow getting there, committed atheistico-materialist I aspired to be, pretending, or hoping, everything was a machine that could be parsed and tinkered and decoded and conquered and possessed by the human intellect, figured out, I guess, myself especially, I wonder. No luck. What is that about? I mean, my God, I wonder if I would have been in my youth a congregant in the Bill Gates et al. Church of the Earth is a half-wit machine we can outsmart, i.e. lube up to make spin better and make a killing while pretending to do so. I really wonder. Maybe kinda I was, though wayward or black sheepishly, given as I could never not take my dreams seriously. Given as though I refused palm readers and astrologers and their occult ilk because... I testified I didn't believe them. It's really because I believe them. Anyhow, alas, thanks to my boundless, bottomless, boundaryless ignorance. Goddamn and holy you know what. Waxing and waning, have you heard? The world again is made to me anew. Which, in a certain kind of way, my friend Penelope explained to me, if I heard this right, is how Descartes thought about wonder. Wonder requires the novel, or the new, he said. He also evidently said wonder is without a companion or opposite emotion, the way happiness has sadness and excitement has lethargy, etc. In this and probably some other things, I disagree with Descartes, because wonder's opposite emotion is know-it-allery. The know-it-all's job is to put a stake in wonder's fat and gooey heart, nothing new under the sun, etc., which, of course, most everything is. New, or become so when we look longer or closer. And so, in addition to touching toes, expressing need, speaking in tongues, getting everything all over the place, wonder, being perpetually wonderstruck, is another thing the very young are our gurus at. It's why they walk so damn slow and never stop with the questions.
Thanks, Ross.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
So when we were talking about it and when you said, well, I'll read it. Yeah. Why, like, yeah. What was that moment where you're like, well,
I know it's partly because I feel like I spend so much time sort of crafting these understandings or these questions. And in a way, it feels like, okay, I know how to say it in this essay. This essay says the question better than I'm going to be able to right now, you know?
So when you say, because the constraint is 30 minutes.
Yeah, drafting at 30 minutes.
Drafting, yeah. Right? So, but then you just said, I've been the craft of it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what does that look like for you? And I know it's not like it's every essay could be the same, probably.
Yeah,
but
that's right. Yeah, so I think that's the first thing, is that probably most essays, it's quite a different thing. I mean, there's the sort of what I would consider the simple craft things of like working on the diction and getting the language clear, quote unquote, and doing this and that. But then there is the deeper question of like how to make the essay surprise me, you know, how to make the essay, which probably a lot of my sort of default modes of writing are going to be out of a particular mode of knowledge, and how do I sort of, dig around inside of the essays so that I can kind of uncover the thing that I actually don't yet know. Which is hard to sort of explain how to do, but as an aspiration, I think it's understandable, you know. It's sort of like, you know, I coached basketball for a while, and I still play a good bit of basketball. And there's all of these things that as a coach you're trying to get your players to do that they can't do. And so you'll always be like even simple stuff like ball handling stuff, like just doing figure eights, like dribbling the basketball between your legs in a figure eight. And you're wanting them to go faster, fast enough that they mess up. Go faster, go faster. If you're not messing up, you're not learning anything. You know, so in a way, like
you're not on that edge.
You're on that edge. Yeah, you want to be sort of like learning something, and in order to learn something, you need to be willing to not know. You know, it's like called practice is actually the word. Yeah, practice. Practice means you're doing what you don't know how to do. You know.
Yeah, and like the daily practice of living.
A daily practice of living. Yeah, maybe like to say that implies like, oh right, it means to be sort of in communion with that which we do not yet know, or do not quite know anyway.
Which is to acknowledge what being a sentient being
exactly.
is, but which so much of, it seems like many, many things around us or our responsibilities or what our perceived duties are encourage us to do otherwise.
Yeah, totally, totally. Yeah, I feel like that's
to fit into a machine.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were to mention the Bill Gates, like how can we
absolutely.
Move it up to spin faster? Sometimes it feels like that for each of us as well, instead of
100%. 100%. Yeah, I feel like it is kind of neat being at, you know, I work at a university too. And universities are a part of that thing.
A machine.
Yeah, they're kind of turning wonder into a kind of, maybe often obliterating wonder.
I think especially at this time at the end of the semester, sometimes mm-hmm. folks are feeling worn out.
Yeah.
And with what's, you know, expected like to be maybe delivered at this moment just the time that it takes to get to this moment in the semester.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And I like how you said it earlier, or I think you alluded to it anyway, the thing of like the regurgitation, the sort of like, you know, fill it up and then let me redeposit it, which is kind of a reference to this pedagogical theorist named Paulo Freire. And he talked about the banking system of education, I think is how he put it. But like, you know, you basically like the student's job is to sort of receive the deposits from the teacher and then they sort of return it. And
right.
Yeah, there's some more interesting way of going about it.
It seems, and banking makes it feel chilly too, like
totally.
and brings that realism of it. But I know that the ideal, right, is that, and why we probably both want to be at a place like a university mm-hmm. and a built space of a university, mm-hmm. Not, you know, a place itself with gathering people into it.
Right.
Is because I think like the, we're supposed to be able to, like you say, I think in Inciting Joy, I think it's in Inciting mm-hmm. Joy, Russ, mm-hmm. like where we are interdependent. You can't pretend to not you're not doing it yourself. Just by your walking around, everything is we all are dependent on everyone else. The same with knowledge, because what we're doing is trying to add more to what we could, the collective can know.
Yeah.
That's the ideal.
Yes. Yes.
But I guess sometimes it doesn't feel like that.
Well, I think in practice, it's often not that. Because I think in practice, it's often, it's about possession. It's about ownership.
Power.
It's about distinguishing oneself. I mean, in a very simple way, school is, I mean, it's many things. And it feels like, for the most part, in a way, like when the most interesting things happen in school, when you're breaking the rules. You know, that seems like the thing. Because so often the objective is simply, you know, evaluation. It's simply a kind of reiteration of a hierarchical mode of life, of thinking, you know, a kind of submitting to authority, on and on and on. And in fact, you know, like when it's interesting, it's not that. It's something else. It's this other thing, which is like, well, let us gather up and tend to our mutual needs. How about that? You know, you know, the dream of the university, which I would say, I'm not like a historian of the university, so I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about my experience in these places, is to imagine that there's a way that we could all become self-sufficient. Which is itself a lie. It's a brutalizing lie.
Right.
And it's part of a kind of mythology of purity, too, I think. I think, you know, if you don't need anything, then you no longer have to be sullied by anything else. You no longer have to get close to anyone else. You no longer have to have your food touched by someone else. You no longer have to all of these things. And in a way, it feels like the university is one of many things that would like us to imagine that that's not only a possible thing, but that's like a good thing to aspire to, a kind of needlessness. But needlessness is a lie, and a fantasy, but the fantasy is also necessarily brutal because it means you're going to be outsourcing your need. You're going to be like burying your need as opposed to being like, oh, I need you. We need each other.
And acknowledging that.
And celebrating.
And that the value of these different needs being met.
Totally. Exactly.
It
feels like a practice. It feels like a practice trying to figure that out. You know, like figure out not only like how are my needs at this very moment, being addressed and you know, clearly like in ways that I could never even fathom.
Right.
But also to sort of, you know, in practice be like acknowledging and loving of our needs in a way, you know? Like I think I was with some grad students the other night for dinner and we were talking about teaching. We were having this beautiful conversation about school, class and teaching. And I can't remember how it came up, but I was like, like one of the things that we want to, that's very difficult, but that you, in a great class, you want to get your students to be able to admit is that they're needy, that they actually need each other.
Yeah.
That makes a very different gathering.
To form a type of community together.
That's
of talking to each other.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. That changes
the
scene.
Learning from each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And being able to also... I think it's the instructor being able to step out of that to not need to be the one that's the conductor.
Yeah.
Or so.
Yeah. Yeah. To just be part of the crew that needs shit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Whoops.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
I'm going to do my best.
So, you know what? Yeah. Not because of that, but we're going to take a short break because, you know, Ross, we usually break at the quarters and we just talked through the first one. So let's hear some of them. Thanks for choosing today's music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You've got Living Writers, everybody. Today on the program, Ross Gay is here. You could see how we could use a couple more hours, I think, but we've only got one before the glorious sports. But we've got the Book of More Delights on the table with us. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be right back.
Three, that's a magic number.
Three.
Yes, it is. It's the magic number.
Three.
Somewhere in this hip-hop soul community was born three, they stubbed me, and that's a magic number.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music, racing three parts. Casually see, but don't do like a soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip-hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk. Three. Parents let go, cause it's magic in the air. Criticizing rap shows you're out of order. Stop looking, listen to the phrase in Fred Astaire's. And don't get offended while Mace Dosey does your daughter. A dry camera roll system is now set. Fly around the store under Daisy Productions. It stands for the inner sound, y'all in your Quebec. That the action not a trick, but show me the function. Everybody wants to be a DJ. Everybody wants to be an MC. But being speakers are the best, and you don't have to guess. Still, our soul posse consists of three, and that's the magic number. This here piece of the pie is not dessert, but the course that we dine. And three out of every darn time, the effect is, where the daisy grows in your mind. Showing true position, this here piece is kissing the part of the pie that's missing, where that negative number fills up your casualty. Maybe you can subtract it, you can call it your lucky partner, maybe you can call it your adjective. But odd as it may be, without my one and two, where would there be my three? Mace, posse, me, and that's the magic number.
What does it all mean?
Focus is formed by flaunt to the soul. Souls who flaunt style gain praises by pounds. Common on speakers who honor the scroll. Scroll written daily creates a new sound. Listeners, listen, cause this here is wisdom. Wisdom of a speaker, a dub and a plug. Set aside a legal substance to feed them for now. Get them high off this dialect drug. Time is a factor, so it's...
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm so glad you did. Today, here in the studio, Ross Gay is here. His book, The Book of More, delights on the table with us. And thanks to Literati for always having so many great books. That's where I was able to pick up my copy as well. So, Ross, the De La Soul, why'd you choose that one for today?
I just love De La Soul so much. I've been listening, kind of getting back deep into them. One of their, basically three guys, and one of them, True Goy the Dove, died coming up on a year ago, not quite a year ago, but, and 54, I think, young guy.
Oh, yeah.
And he was such a... Many things. I love their music for so many reasons, but as I was sort of just like thinking hard about him, I was sort of realizing how important they were actually to my sort of development as a writer and my thinking about like being an artist and stuff. I never in a million years, that's not true. I never in 100 years would have thought about that. I just loved their music, but then I started, after he died, I started like restudying and just like looking at the videos in a hard way and looking at like what they were doing. And I was like, oh, that crew, but him in particular, they kind of, there was something that they were modeling for someone like me that I'm not even yet able to articulate it. But among the things I can articulate something, which was like a kind of sense of parody and a sense of the, a sense of irony, actually, that that I hadn't thought about in their music. You know, so people don't know De La Soul, their first record was 1988 or 89. It's called 3 Feet High and Rising. And the second one is De La Soul is Dead. There's so much play in what they're doing. And a kind of play that I think that I was, even though I didn't know I was learning, even though it took me until now to realize like, oh, I was learning some of that from De La Soul. Now I'm like, oh, of course I was learning some of that from De La Soul. In addition to things like, you know, style and fashion and other things.
But this play.
Yeah, this sense of play. The sense of play while trying to make beautiful things.
Oh.
Yeah.
How old were you?
13.
13.
13. So my memory is so deep of like having the tape of 3 Feet High and Rising, the first record that came out, mm-hmm. and then the second one of De La Soul is Dead in my probably knockoff Sony Walkman.
Nice.
Delivering newspapers at 5 a.m. listening to De La Soul while I was doing my little job almost, you know, every morning. And they were the only people I was listening to, but I was listening to them a lot and studying them. you know, also at a time, and this is kind of interesting for this show, at a time when I didn't read books at all. I wasn't into books or any, nothing like that.
So, but this was, you were reading these texts.
I was reading their lyrics so closely. You know, them and Tracy Chapman and Public Enemy and, you know, other folks.
This time.
Totally,
yes.
Totally. That time.
I'm older than you, Ross, and I got to take, like, I think my senior year of high school, an art class. Like, I was able to finally take one, and we had to work in acrylics, and I think the assignment was something like make an album cover, and I made it for De La Soul.
You did?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That's the best thing ever.
Crazy, right?
Oh, my God.
I don't know. I don't know if they would have liked it, because it had, like, these neon palm trees.
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
That's incredible.
Anyway,
wow.
Anywho.
Yeah, so that's my love for them.
But you're saying 5 a.m. you're also out, like, listening to these songs as you're doing your job, like a paper, right? Yeah, and it's interesting to think that we're not... Like, no one is there saying, Ross, look at the way you're absorbing and processing the world. Look at the things you are reading.
Yep.
Like, sometimes we're getting this. This is the way you read. Yeah. This is the way you learn. Yep. This is the way. And it's in these supposedly neat packages, which never are, because class is often always chaotic.
Yeah.
And what's happening in your mind makes it doubly everyone's mind, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's now when I... talk to young people or work with young people, I'm always like, you were studying in ways you have no idea.
Exactly.
You know, and it might take you like 30 years to know what you were studying, but you were studying, you know, you were studying something, you know, even if all you did was spend your time trying to get out of class, that's a practice.
That's a strategy.
That's a strategy. Yeah. And it probably taught you stuff.
It reminds me of one of the people you write about, I think... Could it be Cootie in here, whose real name is, his government name is something else, but he would, one of the jobs he would do would be to just change a level of the pipe.
Oh, that's my buddy, Skeeter.
So different.
Yeah,
okay.
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He had a job at Minneapolis, you know, pipe and rod or something. And he would, and he was on a line, you know, like a, whatever the line is, the line, and he would, they had to like feed these rods into a machine that would then, I think, kind of bundle them up and keep them going to the next station. And he knew how he could like just feed it wrong, just perfectly, so that no one could tell he did it. And so it would jam the machine and shut everything down for like an hour or two.
And then he would have like a rest.
Yeah, he'd
right?
have to, he and everyone else would have a rest.
I think that's so important.
Oh my God. It's so beautiful. It's such, I love that story. I love it because it's happening all the time. It's happening all the time.
And, you know, and I think another friend then who may or may not be within the same world that you create in this short essay, the friend is a teacher of writing, and he sometimes does in the workshop, has his poetry students take a nap.
That's the same thing.
In class.
Same thing.
I was this is revolutionary.
I'm telling you, it was a class about dreaming, like walking, dreaming, writing or something. And so like for, you know, a third of the semester or whatever, like dreaming was a really big component. So every once in a while, I was like, okay, take a nap.
I love that.
I know. He's such a guide to me. He really is. He showed me so much about teaching and stuff.
And it's so, what was it like for you as a young teacher? Because it feels like you're a natural, you know.
I might be a natural, but I sure as hell wasn't. I didn't act like it when I was teaching because I, like everyone else, was sort of in a panic about being evaluated. So I was trying to be like all those things that the words that I hear now and I just like laugh at them, but like rigorous and, you know, stern. And I like the idea of, I mean, I think I'm just by nature, or I'm sort of friendly in a classroom. Like I'm never like overtly mean. Like I'm not like one of those people, but I did get a kick out of being like tough, you know, in ways.
Okay. So I'm surprised.
Yeah. You have a surprise, you said?
No, I feel surprised to hear
totally.
You say that.
Yeah, absolutely. And tough in various ways. Like, you know, I came out of that era, that kind of workshop era, Though it wasn't the culture that I kind of grew up, like where I went to grad school, I went to Sarah Lawrence, and it wasn't really a thing among the faculty there who were just lovely and brilliant and kind. Marie Howe and Thomas Lux and Gerald Stern and Joan Larkin and David Rivard. Like it wasn't a place where, you know, like people talk about some people who like to like every once in a while rip up someone's poem. That was never happening. Where
that would be awful.
I know. Yeah. That was never happening. But there was a kind of performance of like you knew how to criticize really good. You know, you were a good workshopper if you knew how to criticize. Right. And then
and Marie Howe also, if you're a minute late, don't come in the room.
Oh, was she like that?
Well, when I had her. Because once I was. Yeah. So I was like, ooh, which is not unusual for me. It's not like a new thing to be running a bit.
Me too. Late. That's why I'm like, oh, maybe she got over that by the time I got to her because I would have been out of the room all the time. But you know, so then you come, if that's, you know, one of the things of like being a good workshopper, which is like not a thing to be. To be a good workshopper, I don't think that's an aspiration that anyone really needs to have. But to be a loving observer,
unless we redefine it as totally, yeah, a loving observer
and curious person in regards to other people's work, that's something. But that seems different than like workshop, because workshop implies that you like, you know, you get out your saw and you get out your little hammer and you like.
How yours work.
Not at all. Now it's just like get together. We're going to do these experiments. We're going to play. Often they're going to be collaborative, and we're going to like make them, and we're going to observe them, and figure out what's the next one to make together. We're going to decide it together, and. We're going to make a pile of stuff, and it's probably going to be fun. It's probably going to be collaborative, you know, and we're probably going to learn stuff that actually some of which will be like, oh, yeah, that was sort of a practice in like metaphors or something. But some of it is going to be like, I'm not going to be sure what that was for another 5 years. But pretty sure when we made the movie that was impossible to make based on the people who are writing an impossible screenplay, that's going to show us something, but we'll have to figure out like what that was, you know.
I love that.
Yeah, that's a real exercise. That's a real. First, we had groups got into groups of four or five, and we had to write an impossible screenplay, a screenplay that would be impossible to make.
Yes.
And then we turned it over. No one knew this, but the next class we turned it over to another group of four or five, and it was like, now make the movie. So we had to make all these impossible movies.
And were folks like, were you making them like using your phones or like,
yeah,
what was the constraint?
Or? It was just like, make it however you can. Make it however you can. You know, make this impossible thing however we can. Because I do all the exercises too.
You do?
Yeah.
Is that part of your teaching?
Yeah, totally.
Practice?
Totally, totally.
How so? Are you doing it in the moment with everyone? Or is it that you're changing every semester? You're making new... this experiment you can't let go of. This is good. This you have to do again.
It's a good
one. But what
is
it like for you as a teacher? What does that mean?
Well, like if we're doing just like a very simple thing, which is like in-class exercises of like, you know, writing 50 instances in which you were cared for today, say. We're going to take the first hour of a three-hour class. And that's what we're doing. An hour of writing 50 instances of how you were cared for today. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to do it too. And I'm going to share. And so we're all, but then when we have the impossible screenplay, I'm in a group. And I'm just going to chip in. And then when we make the movie, I'm in the group. And then we're going to make a movie together. So it's not like I'm like, go forth and like do this impossible step. Right. It's like, let's try.
Together.
Let's try together.
Yeah.
And the beautiful...
That's the best, isn't it? Being in on it.
Oh, my God. And then people are like, there's so many things that happen on account of that. One is that you get to join your need with your classes, you know, and that it's no longer your class. It's our class.
Yes. Yes. Huge. And don't you firmly believe that?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. And the other thing is that when you're doing these kind of writing exercises, it's so lovely, especially for like undergrads, when I'm doing it with undergrads, because they're like, oh, you're just like a decent writer. Like, I see.
Like, what I wrote here today.
Yeah,
is
it's like, oh,
a lot shinier totally. Than that.
Yeah, they're like, oh, that's all you make.
You know, but that's so brave of you too. Then, right?
Well, it's kind of because I'm like, I know how to revise.
Yeah.
I know how to revise.
And I will.
Yeah,
and I will.
Yeah,
because the okay. But also, so I don't want to move too much into revise until I just want to give you a shout out because I feel like this is connected to what you've been saying from the top of the hour, Ross. So your teaching is like your way of writing, which is what you also had said. Right. It's what you believe, this philosophy of living, this unmaking to be.
Yeah.
And but in a classroom, that definitely takes a real sense of yourself already, because to be in that position is vulnerable, and with some scenarios, it could take a while for the class to understand how this works, because it's maybe not the norm.
And because we also all have these things beat into our heads about rigor, stuff like that. And I remember, it feels important too to say, like, one, I remember wanting to move toward this, a kind of more experimental, fully collaborative class where we're not like just making poems for publication. We're not just like being little professional writers, but we're actually trying to do stuff we don't know how to do. You know, we're not trying to lock anything in. We're trying to like unlock everything. And I remember, you know, feeling like, okay, this is what we're doing. And then feeling like, in a way, not brave enough to do it, because I could kind of tell that there would be a person or a couple of people who are like, yeah, but this isn't serious. Really, what I want to be doing is just like making poems that I can send to the Kenyon Review. And I am absolutely indebted to the students who are like, yo, you got to keep doing the thing that you're trying to do. Students who are like, yeah, like, we can do that anywhere.
Right.
You know, we can like figure out how to write for a Kenyon Review anywhere, but we can't figure out how to like be together everywhere. You know, that's kind of like what we're trying to do. There's a quote by the writer Fred Moten that I love.
Friend of the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, love Fred so much. And he says at some point, he's sort of talking about teaching the poem Zong by Emnor Bacy Phillip. And he says, it's a kind of an impossible poem to read or to read alone. And so the reason we have to get together in order to read it. And that's one of the things that's beautiful about, you know, a difficult text, but text period, is that we get together to read them. And he says, we got to get together to figure out how to get together. And it feels like that's what class is.
Yeah.
We're practicing gathering.
It has the power, the possibility to
totally,
be that.
Totally, yeah. And so like whenever we're practicing, which I feel like I feel like it's the kind of thing that for as long as I'm teaching, I'll be like learning how to do it, you know?
But
same. Yeah. So what are your classes like?
No, this is about you. In fact, could you read, Ross,
a
poem?
Yeah.
Because I'm loving talking with you, and we talked to other breaks, so we'll just mention some of the songs that folks would have heard.
Okay, we'll close out with one of them. And this is great. So this is from this book called Beholding.
And Beholding.
And it's, you know, even from the title, you can kind of hear that it's probably getting toward what we're talking about, you know. And there's a quote, actually, from Christina Sharp, who I believe is coming here next week. Her book, Ordinary Notes, just came out. But this is from her book, In the Wake, on Blackness and Being. And the quote is, to be held, to behold. To be held, to behold. That's the epigraph. Beholding. April 4th, 2015, until today. And you might have noticed there's nowhere to go. The wind cutting little eddies at your collarbones and behind your ear. As Dr. J drives from the foul line extended to the baseline, defended valiantly by Mark Landsberger. Let me just say to everyone who's listening, who doesn't know who Dr. J is. Dr. J is the best basketball player of all time. Actually, Dr. J is like, you know, Michael Jordan before Michael Jordan. That's a good way to put it. And this poem is, in a way, meditating for a long time and departing from the meditation of Dr. J's probably most beautiful layup in the history of the NBA that happened in the 1980 NBA Finals against the LA Lakers. And you might have noticed there's nowhere to go. The wind cutting little eddies at your collarbones and behind your ear as Dr. J drives from the found line extended to the baseline, defended valiantly by Mark Landsberger, who, in this poem, despite the doofy urge to make him so, is not allegorical, but is rather simply a hard-working journeyman ball player with decent athleticism and size and a floppy mop of dusty blonde hair got caught up in the gust, sliding his size 16s quick so that Doc, after catching the ball at the elbow and taking one hard dribble toward the baseline, where the dunk would usually commence, could not access the paint, or the lane, or the key, which is what we call the area nearest the goal, which, in this case, is an iron hole drawn in space and therefore implies a window, though the key makes it also a door that Landsberger, it seemed, was trying to keep shut. And so Doc leapt. He left his feet, which means, more or less, jumping with the ball with nowhere to go, and which we're warned against by coaches from day one for the ensuing requisite stupid pass, or more simply, though no less stupid, travel, also called walking, which the leaping often leads to. Keep your feet! Again and again, which makes the leaping, leaving your feet, sound sacrificial. The way in certain places, certain countries or countries inside of countries, you must leave by foot with nowhere to go, which there is. And Doc, you should note, after the one dribble, clasps the ball with only his right hand without once at all in any shape or form using the left, which, among other things, friends, differentiates this move from all the descendant moves. Kevin Durant, Dwayne Wade, Steph, and Giannis, and Harden, and Kawhi. Yes, Bron too, I shall not be moved. And using only one hand, which is amazing, but not yet miraculous, more a physical and therefore genetic fact, thanks Ma and Pa Irving, Doc's hand becomes an octopus gripping the ball nothing like prey, and with that ball snugged in his mitt, Doc maybe kinda sorta thought something like, I am gonna put this schmuck, the schmuck in this case being Landsberger, though do not please revert to a simplistic allegorization of the journeyman, which word I repeat advisedly, on a poster. Though schmuck is a word I'd be surprised to hear Doc say. And the word posterize, common usage, posterize his ass, you might be thinking is a bit of an anachronism in this poem, in this move, which ostensibly occurred in the 1980 NBA Finals, though we all know nothing happens only when it happens. We all know nothing happens only when it happens. I'll stop there. Yeah.
Thanks, Ross.
You're welcome. You're very welcome.
And so, Ross, you read that for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
One, because our next program is sports.
Yeah, totally.
So a shout out to the sports department.
Yeah,
here.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a book that gets pretty deep on basketball.
Deep on basketball, but also deep on these other moments.
Absolutely.
Where nothing is, I don't know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, in a way, it's a long meditation on, you know, beholding, the question of beholding. The question is like, how is there a kind of beholding, or i.e. witnessing or looking or regarding, that is also a kind, how we be, might be holding one another? Is there a way to regard one another such that we're actually holding one another, tending to one another?
And that is an ongoing question, isn't it?
That's the ongoing question. That's an ongoing
Ross question. Gay, come back and talk anytime, please.
Thank you.
Please, thanks for this hour.
It's great to talk with you. Yeah, thank you.
Today on Living Writers, Ross Gay, The Book of More Delights. You can get it now. Also, Ross will be reading tomorrow at UMA at 5:30. And then again, the Craft Talk at 10 on Friday. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time. Oh, my Lord. song.
Hey, amigo. Ich bin Sabata. Der Rächer.
Tune in to Faux Show Radio every Monday from 8 to 10 a.m. only here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Join me, your host, DJ Ish, for a musical respite from reality.
Temporary south, easterly, squally, and dusty wind at a speed from 60 to 75 kilometers an hour is likely.
All right, it is time for the pre-polka party show from 6 until 6:30. Although it's going to be relatively polka-ish, I would say. And then from 6:30 to 7, it'll be for real polka. We're going to start with some Brave Combo. And I think we're going to do a lot of Brave Combo for the first half hour. Thanks for tuning in. This is Mick in the driver's seat this week for the pre-polka party and Texas Drive Time Polka Party.